next met with Dr. Malcolm Moore, who chatted with me about pancreatic cancer and began by commenting on the landmark study presented at ASCO and mentioned by Dr. Grothy, evaluating the so-called FOLFIRINOX regimen.
I think there was one very significant paper from a clinical practice point of view, and that was the French randomized study demonstrating the value of an intensive chemotherapy regimen in advanced pancreatic cancer. That's kind of almost like a paradigm shift in this disease where we've always thought of using relatively non-aggressive chemotherapy.
Can you go through a little bit in terms of what they looked at and what they saw?
Well, the Europeans for some time have been developing these combinations of 5-FU, leucovorin, oxaliplatin, and irinotecan in colorectal cancer and have published some interesting data in that disease. They did a small phase 2 study of the same regimen, which is actually full-dose 5-FU, leucovorin, and oxaliplatin with full-dose irinotecan added in. They did a small phase 2 study some years ago in pancreatic cancer and demonstrated some interesting activity, and based on that went then to a randomized phase 2 and then finally a phase 3 study. And at ASCO this year, they basically presented the mature results of the phase 3 study comparing this FOLFIRINOX regimen to gemcitabine.
And what did they see?
Well, quite dramatically, actually, considering how many negative studies we've had in pancreatic cancer, they showed an over 4-month improvement in median survival. So the median survival on gemcitabine was 6.8 months, which is fairly typical for this disease. The median survival on the FOLFIRINOX was 11.1 months. So that's quite a substantial improvement. And certainly, you know, beyond what people have seen with any other regimen in pancreatic cancer. So I think from that point of view, it was an important study and for that reason was highlighted as an oral presentation.
Maybe you could talk a little bit. There were several posters that I saw that you were involved with at ASCO. One looking at comorbidity and overall survival on patients from the NCIC trial of erlotinib plus gemcitabine. Another was a phase 2 trial looking, I guess it was a systemic review with a focus on the design of the studies. And then the third one was looking at smoking status and erlotinib pharmacokinetics. Would you want to go through those three?
Sure. Well, first of all, with respect to the comorbidity, that's really just an attempt through using the database from large cooperative group studies to try and develop some other prognostic factors in pancreatic cancer, mainly so that we can get better signals from phase 2. Right now, our prognostic factors are really relatively crude. We use stage of disease, locally advanced versus metastatic, or we use performance status. And it's really part of an ongoing attempt using the database to try and maybe find some other prognostic factors which might allow us to predict who does well or not. The second study regarding phase 2 was really an attempt to understand why we've had so many negative studies in pancreatic cancer. It's been a field over the past 10 years that has been plagued by probably almost 20 negative phase 3 studies, many of which have gone to phase 3 on the assumption that the regimen tested was being promising. And so what we were trying to do was look at the endpoints in phase 2 studies to try and figure out if there's a better way to do the earlier phase of drug development so that we only take regimens or drugs that look promising to phase 3 and avoid so many negative studies. The third abstract was some years ago in Canada, we did a phase 3 study of gemcitabine plus erlotinib in pancreatic cancer, and that was the one study that did show a small survival benefit. One of the things we observed in that study was that patients who got a rash seemed to do much better, and it's been known from the lung cancer data that patients who smoke have a different metabolism of erlotinib. And so what we were looking at was in a separate study of erlotinib in pancreatic cancer, looking at whether smoking status predicted for toxicity and metabolism. And what we saw was clear evidence that patients who were smokers metabolized the drug more rapidly. And because of that, their maximum tolerated dose was considerably higher than the patients who don't smoke, suggesting that possibly in smokers, you need to start with a higher dose of drug.
Now, these people have to be concurrently smoking?
Well, interestingly, the people who were concurrently smoking had the highest rate of metabolism, but people who were previous smokers had kind of an intermediate phase and still had a higher rates of metabolism than the non-smokers.
So is there any sort of practical difference in terms of how you approach patients?
Well, I just think that if you have patients who are actively smoking, I think one should consider certainly starting at least 150 milligrams a day with a plan to escalate the drug fairly quickly if you don't see a rash or other toxicity.
Interesting. Anything else new in terms of erlotinib, and how do you approach the decision in your own non-protocol practice about whether or not to use it?
Well, at the moment, we think that RAS mutation status is probably going to be important. We don't have definitive data on this yet, but if you look at colorectal cancer, where the EGFR inhibitors really only work effectively in wild-type KRAS patients, in pancreatic cancer, wild-type KRAS is not that frequent. It's probably only about 20% in our experience. But certainly in our Canadian study, the benefit seemed to be much greater in that population. So as we're moving into an era where there are now a number of different options for advanced disease, I think there is some value in testing patients for KRAS. And as I said, there are some larger studies that are exploring that. So we should have a definitive answer within 1 to 2 years.
So when you say there's some value, do you think this is something that maybe should be done outside a protocol setting?
In our own practice, that's what we're doing. Because honestly, in an unselected population, the benefits of erlotinib are relatively modest, much as you would see if you used Herceptin in an unselected population of breast cancer patients. If you use it in a selected population, certainly from our data, the benefits are much greater.
Now, another approach to pancreatic cancer that seemed to be one of the few sort of positive things, at least that I've seen in the last couple of years, was the work on nab-paclitaxel, and that was presented last year. Any updates on that, and what do we know about it at this point?
Well, you're right. It's an interesting observation, and it's in many ways very similar to what we saw with the FOLFIRINOX regimen this year. That is, there's been some phase 2 work done. The data from the phase 2 study looks interesting, and the combination is currently in phase 3. It's also interesting that there are actually two different types of nab-paclitaxel, if you like. The one in North America, there's also a European one that's slightly different. But they also have similar, very promising phase 2 data. And so I think the field is kind of waiting for that data to come out from the phase 3 study. That, in general, is a relatively easy regimen to give to patients. So I think if we were to look at aggressive therapy, you do have to factor in the toxicity and also the tolerability and how easy these drugs are to give. GEM with nab-paclitaxel is a relatively easy treatment to give.
That's interesting that you mentioned this one in Europe. What's the difference in the agents?
The one in Europe is a liposomally encapsulated paclitaxel. The one in North America is bound to albumin. That particular component of it is proprietary technology. So we don't actually get, you know, full details of what the exact differences are. But it's interesting that there is more than one version of this, and both of them do show some interesting activity.
That is interesting. What do you think about the translational work? Dan Von Hoff, when he presented this stuff last year, got into the issue of SPARC. It kind of looked like maybe there was some correlation. What do you think about that?
I think, you know, what SPARC is or how important it is still a bit unclear. I mean, the name itself is very nonspecific. It's really secreted protein rich in cysteine. So the function of this particular protein is not completely understood. And I think the associations with efficacy and such, I think most people feel are still somewhat speculative. So it's really a question at the moment.
I interviewed Mark Sosinski this year, who presented a paper at ASCO looking at nab-paclitaxel and non-small cell. And I keep trying to figure out some of this biology, SPARC and other things. And he talked about the whole issue of albumin and tumors being albumin sponges. Any thoughts about that and whether or not it's relevant to pancreatic cancer?
Well, perhaps the most relevant thing for pancreatic cancer is that we have a very poor sense of how drugs are actually delivered to the tumors. What we know is that the tumors are very poorly vascularized. It doesn't mean there's no vascularity, but they're not really vascular tumors, and the vasculature that's there is quite abnormal. And in addition, you have this very dense sclerotic stroma. And one sort of school of thought is that The reason chemotherapy has not been effective generally is because the delivery of the drug into the actual tumor is extraordinarily poor. And that it's pretty hard to track that, quite honestly, particularly in the primary tumor.
Any comments about supportive care issues in pancreatic cancer?
You know, I've treated pancreatic cancer for a long time. I think it's a very challenging disease. And perhaps one of the rewarding aspects is that you can really help these patients. They're dealing with not only the cancer, they're dealing with a lot of other ancillary issues. Pain, obviously, pain management is crucial in these patients. Another issue is thromboprophylaxis. We actually do use routine thromboprophylaxis in our patients with advanced disease. There's a trial from Europe which suggested that if you do that, it doesn't improve survival. But on the other hand, the incidence of thromboembolic complications is around 25%. And certainly our experience is that if patients have thromboembolic complications, their survival after that tends to be relatively short. We use low molecular weight heparin. And with that, we find the incidence drops considerably. So I think that's also an important factor. And then probably the thing that's overlooked, I think, the most is gastric outlet obstruction. These tumors are in the pancreatic head, many of them. Patients often have nausea and vomiting. And I can think of several patients where the nausea and vomiting was attributed to the analgesia or to just the debility of the disease. But if you dug a little deeper, you found out that they had early satiety, they could eat better in the morning. And then when we did the radiology studies, they had an outlet obstruction. And I have one patient in particular who we surgically went in and fixed it about 18 months ago. He had metastatic disease. And once that was done, his performance status improved considerably, and he's still on treatment.
Let's talk a little bit about biliary tract cancers. Anything that's developed over the last year or two that you want to comment on from a research perspective?
Well, this is another area that's in evolution. There was really a dearth of good quality phase 3 studies in biliary tract cancers, although all of us anecdotally had seen very nice responses with gemcitabine-based therapies, either gemcitabine platinum or gemcitabine capecitabine. And our local treatment, if you like, had been gemcitabine capecitabine, just based on our own phase 2 data. So when the British study came out at ASCO last year showing a survival benefit of gem-cis over gemcitabine, that was not at all surprising. And it's certainly, I think, a treatment that can be highly effective in some patients. That was the first large study of biliary tract cancer that was done in England. This is really a disease that has a very unusual geographic distribution. It's very common in Chile. In fact, it's the gallbladder cancer, which we include in this basket of biliary tract cancers, is the leading cause of cancer death in women in Chile. And it's also very common in Japan and Southeast Asia. So we don't have as many such patients in North America. And so, again, this is an area, in many ways like gastric cancer and others, where the role of targeted therapy is still in its infancy, and people are just starting to look at that.
Any explanation for why you see it, this geographic variation, what's going on in Chile and Asia?
No, that's kind of the million-dollar question, because particularly in Chile, which in many ways is a very developed country, it doesn't seem to be an ethnic thing, and it's really poorly understood.
Let's talk about one of your patients. How about this 25-year-old woman with pancreatic cancer?
Well, again, being a larger center, we tend to get the more unusual cases referred to us. This is probably one of the younger people that I've run into with pancreatic cancer. And our suspicion was that she either had a genetic predisposition, or unlikely what had happened is that this had developed in a pre-existing cystadenoma. And because of that, we have the ability now to sequence these tumors. And so we did do some sequencing on her because we just thought this was a bit of an unusual circumstance. But at the time of diagnosis, she had both this large pancreatic tumor and two lesions in her liver that were biopsy confirmed to be adenocarcinoma. But in her particular case, she was KRAS wild type. And at the time she came to us, we had a study of gemcitabine, erlotinib, and she originally went on the study and had a very good response to that particular treatment.
Interesting. Anything else that was seen in the tumor that gives any clues in terms of, you know, why she might have gotten it and what she might have responded to?
Not really. I mean, we've, like many of these younger people, we've tested her family and we don't see any germline defect that would account for this. The interesting thing in her case was that she had a terrible rash on the erlotinib, and at the end of the day was only able to tolerate about 50 milligrams a day. But despite that, she actually continued to respond to erlotinib for almost 4 years.
4 years?
Yep.
Wow. And so she actually had an objective response?
She had a definite response. And what we did with her actually was several times we stopped her treatment because radiologically things were improved. In each case, the disease slowly returned. We put her back on treatment and it went back into remission. And about 2 years after we started her on treatment, actually, we actually resected her primary just because the size of it was causing her some difficulties. And it's a very unusual case, but I like to present it because I think in a way we have to start thinking about these individual idiosyncrasies of disease and realize that we don't approach every patient the same way.
When they resected her, I'm guessing they looked at her liver, or did they biopsy her liver, or what was going on with her liver?
Well, actually, what they did when they resected her was she had two lesions in the left lobe of her liver, which were readily accessible. They took those out because it was relatively easy to do, and those were adenocarcinoma, as was predicted.
It's interesting. I was going to bring up the issue of resection of liver mets, and I was thinking, pancreatic cancer, you would never do that. I mean, how often have you done that?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I'd want to be advocating a resection of metastatic pancreatic cancer. I think when you're dealing with diseases that have a median survival of 6 months, that's not appropriate. But again, in this particular case, because she'd had such a long disease control period, and because she had disease which was surgically resectable based on the visible disease, we went ahead and did it. That was 2 years ago. She's still on treatment, actually, and she's just finished 3 years of university while on treatment. So again, I think there, like anything, there are very individual cases where you might do something that's slightly different than the norm. And part of having experience is understanding when it may be the right thing to do.
Is she still on GEM also, or just the erlotinib?
She's on both.
Wow, for 4 years.
Yeah.
Do you think that eventually, you know, the rare patient like this, we may turn out something like what's been seen in non-small cell lung cancer, some type of oncogene addiction or, you know, in that case, EGFR mutation?
Yeah, I think there's no question. We used a technology called sequenome, which tests for about 23 common mutations. And it was interesting that in her case, we did not see any of the common mutations in her cancer. So there's obviously something very unique about her situation.
So she really didn't have that kind of appearance that you described before of multiple defects, which kind of makes sense. She's young, you know, maybe something else is going on.
That's right, yeah.